Crusade Channel News. News you can trust because the truth can be trusted. From the Crusade Channel News Desk, here's Celeste Youngblood.
Good afternoon, Crusaders. I'm Celeste Youngblood coming to you from the Veritas Radio Network News Bureau with your headlines at this hour on this Thursday, January 11th, 2018. Indigenous Filipinos are risking their lives to defend their land. Then I'll have your stock market report and saint of the day. Somalians aren't the only ones rioting over economic hardship. And is there a light at the end of the tunnel for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange? France 24 reports that indigenous Filipinos are risking their lives to defend their land against miners and agribusiness. The Philippines is the deadliest country in the world for environmental and land rights. The Lumads in particular, who hail from the southern part of the island of Mindanao, which we covered extensively during the siege of the city of Marawi, are a non-Muslim indigenous peoples made up of Christians and animists who are defending their lands, yet are being accused of being in cahoots with the communist New People's Army.
According to Pan Asia Pacific, 61 deaths were reported, and many were related to conflicts over mining and agribusiness. Now, those who resist big business often find themselves in the firing line of private security companies and state forces. Last year, martial law was declared in the state of Mindanao, and rights groups say that this is allowing the military to target land defenders, in particular indigenous Lumads. They accuse them of being members of the communist New People's Army. Jack Hewson reports.
Filipino rights defenders set out on a journey to the remote hills of southern Mindanao, a region subject to island-wide martial law. According to advocacy group Pan Asia Pacific, the Philippines was the deadliest country in the world for land and environmental defenders in 2017, with 61 killed. Arlene Perez says it is safer to travel in large numbers.
We were told that there are some military guys in this area right now, at the very least. At the most, we hope we don't get massacred or killed.
Here in the village of Datol Bonlangan, seven indigenous Lumads were shot dead by the military on December 3rd. The Lumads say it was a massacre of civilians, but the military have denied this, saying there was a crossfire with communist rebels.
Yeah, we just arrived. Edwin, who is from this area, he's telling the story to the members of the team of really what happened on last December 3.
Edwin Glam says the day of the incident began with a district official arriving to persuade their village head, Datu Victor Danyan, to surrender.
This is what our village leader, Datu Victor, told him. I'm not a fighter, I'm not a rebel, I'm just defending our land so that mining will not enter our lands. He would also not allow the renewal of the coffee plantations by Kunsungi.
Kunsungi is the name of a group of companies that the Lumads say control the land. They say an affiliate company of Kunsungi took their ancestral land unlawfully. Edwin believes that Danyan was targeted because of this resistance.
I was standing by that big tree over there. There was a gunshot, and I immediately saw Datu Victor fall to the ground. He was shot in the head, and right here in the chest. The gunshot came from that hillside over there. We were afraid that Datu Victor had died, but I picked him up and brought him inside this house. With the death of our leader, our community is calling out for justice, that his death doesn't go unnoticed.
Responding to the claim that the Kunsungi group was responsible for the incident, a parent company spokeswoman said they would not react to hearsay and malicious, unsubstantiated reports from unverified third parties. The armed forces of the Philippines declined to comment, but previously have released videos of armed men walking from the scene, proof, they claim, that the communist New People's Army, or NPA, were present. The NPA have fought an insurgency against the government for 50 years. In Manila, I put these claims to Christina Palabe, a spokeswoman for Karapatan, an NGO that has supported the Lumads.
Even if there is a crossfire, that doesn't mean that they can kill Datu Danyan. Even if there are direct armed confrontations of the military and the NPA rebels, a massacre is a massacre. You don't kill civilians, even during situations of armed conflict.
The radical disparity between the activist and military narratives make it difficult to know exactly what happened in Datol Bonlangan, But what is clear is that the military and trained militias often intimidate communities to secure land for agribusiness and mining. These images taken in 2014 show private security firing on Lumads in North Mindanao. In an even more notorious incident in 2015, a Lumad village head was executed in front of his entire community. Here at a demonstration in Manila, Euphemia Kulamat tells me how witnessing the execution affected her community.
We think that these acts are intended to create a chilling effect on our struggle. But we won't stop because we know that our struggle for our right to self-determination and for our ancestral domain is a just one. We will persevere in our struggle until they respect our right to self-determination.
Experiences like Euphemia's have made many Lumads sympathetic to the communist cause. But the distinction between communist sympathizer and rebel fighter is often blurred by the authorities. Critics have accused President Duterte of concocting a red scare for political gain.
Two-thirds of the Lumads are constitute the membership of the DNP, the armed force of the Communist Party. I will not wait until they are about to slit our throat. There is actually rebellion in Mindanao.
The president has used such fiery rhetoric to justify the one-year extension of martial law in December. This creeping authoritarianism, coupled with the recent breakdown of peace talks with the communist rebels, means tensions will only be ramped up further. As a result, life for the Philippines' land and environmental rights defenders is likely to remain as dangerous as ever.
For more on this story, we can bring in David Kamhu, resident senior associate at Sciences Po in Paris and co-editor of the Journal of Current Southeast Asian Affairs. Thank you very much for joining us on the program. Now, martial law was declared in Mindanao to get rid of the jihadists last year. Now, the government has extended it because they're comparing what they think are rebels to jihadists, essentially.
Well, in some ways it's interpreted as Duterte doing what Marcos did some 40 years ago, that is using martial law to then extend his term in office, which is limited to a 6-year one term. But yes, there are two Mindanaos. There's this northern part where we find these indigenous groups defending their land and against mining companies. And in the south, we have a Islamic-inspired insurrection, which is, again, something that's gone on for decades, at least maybe even a century.
Now, the government is denying civilians have been targeted, and if any were killed, they're saying it's been crossfire with communist rebels. Given the heavy-handed tactics of the government of Rodrigo Duterte with the war on drugs, for instance, we don't believe them, do we?
No, there's no credibility. 12,000 people have been killed extrajudicially since the war on drugs has been started. We estimate half of them being killed by the police and the other half by policemen moonlighting or by militias. And so we're in a situation where the Philippines has a strong regime but a weak state. We have a situation in which the rule of law doesn't actually function in practice. A country which is lacking 50,000 magistrates, for example, so that when people are imprisoned there, they never come to trial. And so there is this, the use for, doing justice yourself and appealing to militias to, in fact, carry out these forms of justice. So in this case, really defending mining companies.
Now, NGOs are trying to hold the government and companies accountable for the violence. But with Rodrigo Duterte in the country's top job, and as you say, there's no rule of law in many parts, is there any hope at all?
Well, there is hope because there is a degree of freedom of the press in the Philippines. There is still the Catholic Church, which is influential as a moral force, which defends the ethnic people and is opposed to the war against drugs. So there is indeed some hope. But Duterte is conducting a rather clever policy, which is both heavy-handed militarily and in terms of the war on drugs. But at the same time, he's trying to spend massive amounts of money on on infrastructure to encourage investment, particularly in Mindanao, in the mining industry. He's fired his environmental minister, who was an environmentalist several months ago. So he's being supported by big business, by multinational corporations, and at the same time, he was elected with the support of the left, and even he had ex-communists in his government. But now that they've served their purpose, he's abandoning them, and he's using this war in the situation in Mindanao, the occupation of Mirawi, which went on for about 6 months, in order to perhaps push his authoritarian agenda in the country.
So what should indigenous communities be doing now in Mindanao, for instance, to defend their land? You mentioned a free press, but what other options do they have?
Well, the other important element is to have the world watching. There's been reports about Malawan, another island part of Mindanao, where there are environmental vigilantes, or people actually not violently but defending their land, which have had a degree of success. So, I mean, there's a need for international support. There is support within the Philippines itself, but Duterte's war on drugs and the terrorist activity in southern Mindanao has given him an excuse to go even further in his authoritarian tendencies, particularly in a context where he's got Donald Trump. He's in a bromance with Donald Trump, so he's not going to be condemned by the big brother in the United States.
Clearly isn't.
And now it's time for your business and market report. South Korea is planning on banning cryptocurrency trading, and predictably, Bitcoin prices have plummeted. Reuters' Grace Lee reports.
Turmoil for the Bitcoin market on Thursday as South Korea announces it may ban cryptocurrency trading altogether. While lawmakers the world over are struggling with how to regulate Bitcoin, Seoul has been opting to clamp down on trade, worried over its frenzied local popularity. Its skyrocketing value last year drew students and housewives into investing. Now the justice minister says a bill is in the works to put digital coins off limits. That's after police raided local exchanges on alleged tax evasion this week, following moves by the finance ministry to find ways to tax the fast-growing market. Analysts say it's the so-called herd behavior that has officials worried. The sheer volume of investors jumping into the market has created a hefty premium for cryptocurrencies in South Korea. But after the announcement on Thursday, the price of Bitcoin plummeted as much as 10% on the Bitstamp exchange, and it's unclear how a future ban might affect prices. Korean authorities also say they're inspecting six local banks that offer virtual currency accounts to institutions, saying they're worried cryptocurrencies could lead to a surge in crime.
Reuters reports that Canada believes the United States is going to pull out of NAFTA. Mexico has said that they will also quit the deal if Trump announces plans to withdraw. Reuters reports.
Forward to working with the
Canada is increasingly convinced President Donald Trump will announce plans to pull the United States out of NAFTA. Government sources told Reuters, quote, "The government is increasingly sure about this. It is now planning for Trump to announce a withdrawal."
The fact is, NAFTA, whether it's Mexico or Canada, is a disaster for our country.
Trump has criticized the North America Free Trade Agreement, a trade pact that went into effect in 1994. The deal reduced trade barriers. Critics, including Trump, say it resulted in U.S. manufacturing jobs moving to Mexico. Proponents say it also provided cheaper consumer goods to U.S. shoppers. The Trump administration last year asked Mexico and Canada to begin renegotiating the deal.
Canada, the United States, and Mexico have a powerful shared interest in reaching a mutually beneficial agreement.
But in five rounds of talks, Canada and Mexico have balked at some U.S. proposals. And a U.S. source close to the White House quoted Trump as saying, "I want out," as the talks showed little sign of progress. A White House spokesman said there has been no change in the president's position on NAFTA. Sources say the Trump administration could announce plans to withdraw, giving 6 months' notice, as a negotiating ploy to extract concessions. And it is not certain the U.S. would quit the deal even if 6 months passed. But others might. Sources in Mexico involved in the trade talks say that country's government would leave the pact if Trump announced plans to withdraw. Officials will hold the second-to-last round of talks in Montreal starting January 23rd.
European shares were faltering this morning over NAFTA concerns. Reuters' David Pollard reports.
Fake news, say Chinese regulators, but the aftershock from reports that China may pare back purchases of U.S. treasuries is very real. China's holding of U.S. government debt is at $1.2 trillion, the world's largest. Any swing in that could be enough to topple bond and equity market prices globally. Worries that sent U.S. Treasury yields to 10-month highs, though bond buyers later returned, and the dollar to its biggest one-day drop against the yen in 8 months.
It is a very clear and a loud message that perhaps debt Armageddon could be heading towards the market, one of the biggest meltdown.
Some see in the bond reports a tacit warning to the U.S. step back from protectionism. Though, if anything, Donald Trump may take a step closer and soon announce he's to go through with a threat to quit NAFTA. According to Canadian government sources, Mexico government sources said if it happens, it too may leave the negotiating table. That is, if Donald Trump doesn't return to it first, under another possible scenario.
He sends out the threat that I'm going to pull out, but then he jumps back on the table and he goes, "What? You know what? We are going to do a different agreement. So we will have another version of a NAFTA, which is an improved version, which will perhaps, improve his ratings."
What upbeat news there was came from Chinese Premier Li. He says China's 2017 growth should, at an expected 6.9%, beat forecasts. Markets see its chances of doing so again in 2018 revolving around the two key issues that dominate sentiment: trade and protectionism.
Let's see what the markets are doing today. In early afternoon trading, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 126 points at 25,495. The NASDAQ was up 30 points at 7,184. The S&P 500 was up 11 points at 2,759. Crude oil was up a dollar at $64.57 a barrel. In the world markets, the Japanese Nikkei closed down 78 points and the Hong Kong Hang Seng closed up 47. The London FTSE 100 closed up 14 points and the DAX in Germany closed down 78. Today's quote of the day comes from St. Jane Frances de Chantal. Hold your eyes on God and leave the doing to Him. That is all the doing you have to worry about. Coming up next after the break in Lives of the Saints and Martyrs, we honor St. Theodosius. You're listening to Crusade News.
Thomas Jefferson was famous for a lot more than life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if you're waiting for Hollywood to put that on film,
you may as well wait for the next Ice Age.
That's why I started FoundingFatherFilms.com. Hi, I'm Mike Church, and I invite you and your family to see and hear the greatest Founding Father stories never told in my movies, The Spirit of 76 and The Road to Independence, on DVD and CD, and available now at FoundingFatherFilms.com. That's FoundingFatherFilms.com, or call 866-483-3833.
Born in 423, Theodosius the Cenobiarch was a monk and abbot who founded and organized the Cenobitic method of monasticism, which stresses community life over solitude and is regulated by a religious rule. Theodosius hailed from Margarissos in Cappadocia and was the son of pious parents. He felt the calling to imitate Abraham in leaving behind his family, friends, and all worldly trappings to follow God. On his way to Jerusalem during the time of the Fourth Ecumenical Council of Chalcedon, he spent some time with St. Simeon the Stylite, who blessed Theodosius and prophesied his spiritual glory. He started off as a hermit, but received so many visitors and pilgrims he had to flee to a cave on the peak of a mountain. His diet was extremely sparse, and he prayed at all times. He later formed a multicultural and multilingual community of monks near Bethlehem, which worked with the sick, the elderly, and the mentally challenged. Theodosius died near Jerusalem around the age of 105. St. Theodosius, pray for us. Earlier this week, we brought to you the story of the Somali bread riots, which had claimed the life of a student. Somalia isn't the only country in revolt over economic hardship and the price of food. Tunisians have been rioting for days, France 24 reports.
The demonstrations started out peacefully. A week ago, activists from the What Are We Waiting For movement took to the streets to bring attention to the rising cost of living. In addition to the 1% increase in the value-added tax, many Tunisians are worried about the rising costs of fuel, fruits and vegetables, and other products that have gotten more expensive over the past few months.
The market is empty. Look, people can't even cook anymore. Why does a kilo of chickpeas cost 8 dinars? 8 dinars for a kilo? Seriously, what is this?
For the trade minister, the budget law is a necessary evil to jumpstart the Tunisian economy.
There are reforms to limit the budget deficit because as long as we have a deficit, there will be inflation. And to limit the deficit, we have to increase the state's revenues by increasing taxes. I hope it'll just be a difficult phase that Tunisia has to go through, but one that's necessary to stabilize public finances, to be able to get the country back on the right track.
Since the Arab Spring in 2011, Tunisia has faced a prolonged economic crisis.
WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has been residing in London's Ecuadorian embassy for 5.5 years now with no end in sight. The 46-year-old Assange has refused to leave the embassy, fearing extradition to the United States. The Independent reports that this week the UK refused a request by Ecuador to give Assange, formerly an Australian, diplomatic status. This week, Ecuador issued an Ecuadorian identification number to Assange, saying that they seek a, quote, dignified and just resolution of this lengthy saga. We turn to RT for a more in-depth treatment of this story.
Of Julian Assange allegedly getting some sort of identification there from Ecuador. There's a bit of confusion about what exactly is going on. Early reports coming in, he'd been granted Ecuadorian citizenship. It's now claimed he's only been handed an identity card for the country. So a bit of uncertainty about what exactly is going on there. Let's cross live to our correspondent, Anastasia Churkina, who's in the middle of it all next to the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where, of course, Assange remains holed up. Anastasia, a confusing picture tonight, really. What's the latest we do know? What does it mean? What could it mean, rather, for Assange if these reports turn out to be true?
Well, Dan, the mystery of what happens next in this ever-complicated, tricky and internationally spanning case of Julian Assange really continues with some developments trickling in this evening here in London, where we are, in fact, outside the Ecuadorian embassy. And some of the confusion of some of the reports that have been coming out seems to be stemming from, first of all, a tweet that Julian Assange had posted on his Twitter page wearing a T-shirt with the Ecuadorian national colors, sparking lots of debate and questions online about whether or not this could potentially mean that he has been or is on his way to being granted citizenship. Those questions, of course, are yet to be specifically answered by either Julian Assange himself, the founder of WikiLeaks, or Ecuadorian officials. What we do know so far is that Assange seems to have been issued some sort of national Ecuadorian identification number, which is easily seen on the Ecuadorian website, where this particular number coincides with his full name. Now, the questions there are whether or not this is an ID that could potentially be used for him to apply for Ecuadorian citizenship or somehow change his status when it comes to this very complicated case that has now spanned over several years. What we do know is this comes following earlier statements from the Ecuadorian foreign minister saying that it's really time to move on with his case. Let's take a listen.
A person can't live in those conditions forever. We're considering the option of mediation. That could be done via a third country or individual. No solution is possible without international cooperation or without that of the UK, which has expressed interest in finding one.
Well, there are lots of questions now about who this potential mediator could be, because obviously when it comes to the complications of Julian Assange being able to actually step out of this embassy behind us revolves largely on what his status is in the UK, because clearly it's been made very clear many times over and over by British officials that even if he does step foot outside the embassy, he would be snatched up by them for the simple reasons of having breached his bail when around the time of when his whole case began to unravel. So that has been the position of the British officials, of course, despite having the world seen that organizations such as the United Nations have found his detention to be arbitrary, that the Swedish investigation that has been going on for quite some time, having dropped the sexual allegations against him, there were lots of assumptions there that this would open the door for Assange to walk out of this Ecuadorian embassy where he's been holed up. But obviously, all of this has been based largely on the fact that Assange himself believes that as soon as he walks out, he would be extradited to the U.S., which seems to be his biggest fear, given the expectation for him to be punished there for his work as a whistleblower with the website WikiLeaks, having provided so much information when it comes to certain doings of the American government. So certainly lots of questions. We're going to obviously be watching this very closely in terms of what is this going to mean for Assange's status, not just within Ecuador, but potentially his case beginning to move forward a little bit more.
Probably more questions than answers at this point, Nastasia. Any time it seems closer to a resolution, the case gets more cryptic and more complicated. And Nastasia Shurkin there bringing us the latest from outside the Ecuadorian embassy. Well, let's discuss this further. We can go live to human rights campaigner Peter Tatchell, who's the director of the Peter Tatchell Foundation. Peter, thanks for coming on today. As you probably heard there from our correspondent who's outside there, case remains pretty murky right now, lack of real information, bit of a confusion as to what's going on. If this turns out to be correct, an identity card has been issued, what could that mean for Julian Assange? Is this a serious step to a resolution of this seemingly endless saga?
Well, as your report suggested, the Ecuadorian government has made it very clear they want a resolution and they're prepared to negotiate. They want a way of Julian Assange leaving the embassy to clear up the fact that he's been holed up there all these years. That's clearly their desire, publicly expressed. The granting of an identity card is, of course, potentially the first step towards being granted citizenship of Ecuador. And beyond that, the possibility that he could be granted diplomatic status, which would give him diplomatic immunity. And the suggestion might be that if he was granted diplomatic immunity, he would therefore be free to leave the embassy and travel to Ecuador, and the British government would not be able to lay a finger on him. That is, of course, speculation. It's a long way down the road yet, but clearly the granting of an identity card is a movement, a new development, which may open the door to further things in the future.
I mean, this has obviously been going on for five and a half years. I've done multiple reports myself from outside that embassy as well. And, you know, as we said earlier, any time there is a step forward, a lot of questions still do remain. But, I mean, neither an ID card nor a passport, at this stage at least, give him immunity unless it's a diplomatic passport. So really, as Anastasia still said, he's still liable for arrest, of course, as soon as he steps out of that embassy, isn't he?
That's right, and that is still the official position of the British government. The question I think British people have to ask is there a public interest in continuing to pursue Julian Assange? I think it's a very thin public interest, if one at all. This saga has dragged on for far, far too long. I don't think there's any compelling public interest reason why the British government should keep on pursuing him. I think probably behind the scenes, many British officials would be very happy to see the end of Julian Assange. And if ultimately a diplomatic passport and immunity was a way of exiting the country, then certainly that is something that many British officials would be glad of. Of course, there is the question, the convention is that someone who has a diplomatic passport is immune from prosecution. That is the way it's been traditionally dealt with. There is, of course, no guarantee that past traditions will be a guide to future practice. There is still the possibility that even if he was granted a diplomatic passport and immunity by the Ecuadorians, the British government might still try to snatch him. That would be a very serious breach of diplomatic protocol and convention. I doubt the British would go that far. But on the other hand, there are some people in the British establishment who really want to get him. So I wouldn't rule out anything at this particular point in mind or point in time. One thing I would say is that on the question of diplomatic immunity, in 2001, I was beaten unconscious by the bodyguards of President Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe in Brussels, and his bodyguards claimed diplomatic immunity. The British government did not contest that. They decided to take no action against the bodyguards of President Mugabe for beating me unconscious. Likewise, the Belgian government as well. So if they didn't recognize diplomatic immunity, if that's what Julian Assange eventually gets through a diplomatic passport, but then recognized it in the case of a violent assault, that would be an incredible contradiction, an incredible double standard. So my feeling and hope is that diplomatic immunity and passport will come, and that that will be the way of Julian Assange exiting the UK and seeking and securing asylum in Ecuador.
Indeed, quite a shocking example you gave there of, the diplomatic immunity and whether that is observed or not. I mean, at this stage, as you quite rightly pointed out, Pete said the key thing is not to rule anything out. All possibilities are open. But let's just speculate for a minute that this does go ahead, that he is issued a passport, diplomatic immunity. Why has this taken 5 years to do? This does seem like a very convenient way out of the situation. It's 5 years down the road. If it was this simple, issue him a passport, issue him that diplomatic immunity, seems straightforward enough. Why has it taken this long, do you think?
Well, you forgive me, I'm not entirely up to speed with the Ecuadorian government's rules with regard to citizenship. And maybe he's had to serve a time on Ecuadorian territory, which is what the embassy is, in order to be considered for citizenship. So maybe the delay is simply because you have to be in Ecuadorian territory for X number of years before you can be considered for citizenship. And maybe now Julian Assange is approaching that limit. And so therefore a citizenship could be granted and then a passport following. That's my speculation.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. That does sound quite logical, Pete, although I'm no expert on Ecuadorian law either. I mean, just finally, you mentioned there perhaps many British officials, many figures in the establishment you mentioned will be happy to have an end to this saga. It is, causing at the least a PR problem, perhaps for the British government on the international stage. If this does go ahead, how do you think British authorities could react to the move by Ecuador? Would you be surprised if they did block this diplomatic immunity move, or would they be happy, as you mentioned, to wash their hands of him and put an end to this five-year saga?
I think that if a diplomatic passport and immunity was granted to Julian Assange, I think the British government would be quite reluctant to breach that convention. They wouldn't like it, because there are people there who really want to get him. But I think they recognize that if you start breaking this convention, then where does it start and where does it end? There could be retaliatory actions against British officials whose diplomatic immunity could be challenged. So it would be a very extreme move for the British to take. The final point I'd just like to say is we have to remind ourselves that whatever you think about Julian Assange, his WikiLeaks organization did perform a great public service by shining a light on human rights abuses. He was not himself a whistleblower, he was a publisher, but he did publish the leaks of others, such as Chelsea Manning with the Iraq war logs, which show the horrendous example of the killing of innocent civilians by a US helicopter crew in Iraq. Shining a light on those kind of abuses was a great public service. And even if you have some criticisms of the way he and WikiLeaks have behaved on some issues, you can't take away from the fact that he did help expose things that successive governments wanted to keep hidden from the people of the United States and indeed the world. And in that sense, I think he is somewhat of a hero, regardless of other criticisms that may be made.
Indeed, he's certainly as much admired as he is a figure of controversy internationally as well. We'll be keeping updates, of course, on that throughout the night, throughout tomorrow, to see what those details are. Peter Datchell, human rights campaigner, director of the Peter Datchell Foundation, thanks for coming on such short notice and giving us your take on what could happen there.
In this Celestial Musings, I came across an article with the New York Post yesterday about tennis player Serena Williams. She had recently had her first baby at the age of 36, and the article talked about the struggles that she experienced as a newly postpartum mother. It talked about the symptoms she felt, which alerted her to the blood clots she knew were in her lungs, and how she had to put her foot down with the doctors and nurses and advocate for herself to get the heparin that she knew she needed and also a scan. The article also talked about her psychological struggles. The full interview can be found in the February edition of Vogue. What struck me was that she mentioned something to the effect that she was woefully unprepared for the psychological struggles she would undergo after giving birth. This came as no surprise to me. Most women are little prepared for birth and not at all prepared to navigate the postpartum world. The more women, like Serena Williams, speak out about their experiences, however, the less alone other women will be when they themselves go through the same. Sadly, I went back to the same article yesterday evening and found that the best parts of the article, the ones that I had mentioned previously, were all scrubbed from the article. I think this action simply illustrates my point that if we're going to raise awareness of the perils of postpartum life, we have to stop hiding the reality of it. I have my experiences, my friends have theirs. It's more common than any of us realize, and yet when we're in it, we couldn't feel more alone. For those who don't know, I worked in the birth field before switching to newscasting. I've had experiences with 10 of my own postpartums. I've had experiences with my friends and my clients. A friend asked me what we should do for our daughters and even our daughters-in-law as far as this postpartum education is concerned. She asked if it was enough for them to see our experiences and talk to them about it and educate them as much as they ask for. My response to her was that, yes, we need to educate our daughters and our sons and their spouses, especially our daughters' spouses or our sons, because sometimes we mothers do not see our issues cropping up. You know, when you're right in the middle of it, you don't necessarily see the forest from the trees. But our spouses can. And there needs to be more inclusion of the topic in birth preparation classes, because even if the mother doesn't experience postpartum issues with her first baby, maybe she will on her third baby or her fourth baby. And who's going to be taking a birth prep class at that point? Very, very few. You either know what to expect and what you're doing, or you're getting a scheduled cesarean section and you don't need the birth classes. But that mom who learned about the signs of postpartum issues, whether the physical ones or the psychological ones, maybe she'll remember those warning signs that she heard in her classes years ago. We have babies and we take them for checkups at 2 months and 4 months and 6 months. But who's checking up on us? Who's checking up on our physical and emotional well-being after the first 6 weeks? Nobody. I didn't recognize unusual postpartum mood issues until my fifth baby was several months old, and by the time I had my ninth, I was still not as aware as I should have been. What it looked like in my 20s was not what I experienced in my early 30s, and was a far cry from the frightening experience I had at 39. I've done my best among those that I know to be very open and frank about my experiences in hopes that they too can be helpful for someone. Even if it's like through a friend telling another friend, saying, you know, I have a friend who went through that. So kudos to Serena Williams for using her platform to speak up about postpartum issues. I see celebrities doing this more and more, and hopefully it's having an impact. Because rich or poor, famous or not, these issues do not discriminate. When it comes down to it, we all put our socks on 1 foot at a time. And we women are all subject to these crosses when we bear children. So let's make sure that we're taking care of one another. Send me your news tips at news@veritasradionetwork.com. Keep yourself tuned in to the Veritas Radio Network for king-size truth from radio-sized speakers. Coming up next, The True Money Show. Celeste Youngblood signing off for the Crusade Channel. Serving you, serving truth.
You've just heard Crusade Channel News. Live on your News Talk and Saints leader, the Crusade Channel. And did you know that all newscasts are available as podcasts on CrusadeChannel.com and on our free app available in the Google Play and iTunes stores? surprised?
If I woke up tomorrow with my head sewn to the carpet, I wouldn't be more surprised than I am right now.
Crusade Channel News. News you can trust. Because the truth can be trusted.